Welcome to the War in Ukraine update from Kyiv podcast.
I'm Jessica Ganawa, a lecturer in international relations at Flinders University in Australia, and I'm delighted to be speaking today with Mick Ryan. Mick is a retired Major General of the Australian Army. Mick served in the Australian Defence Forces for over 35 years and acted as commander of the Australian Defence College, so quite a wealth of knowledge. And Mick is a frequent commentator and analyst of military strategy, as well as updates on ongoing events as they're taking place currently in Ukraine. And you can follow Mick on Twitter if you'd like to get more information about his frequent updates on that. Mick's recent book, War Transformed: The Future of 21st Century Great Power Competition and Conflict, is an exceptionally relevant book, amazing timing, just released in February, that engages in a valuable and insightful exploration of the constraints and transformations in military conflict in the uncertain and complex global environment in which we're all operating in the 21st century. So I highly recommend that all listeners check that out if you haven't already, and I'll put a link to where you can find the book in the show notes. So I look forward to having a discussion with Mick today about some general strategic aspects of the conflict in Ukraine. Thanks so much for joining me today, Mick.
Thanks, Jessica. It's great to be with you.
Since the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February this year, we've seen Russia fail to perform militarily in a way that we might have expected from a significant global military power. Can you explain, in your evaluation, how do you assess Russia's performance in the war post 24th of February and their military strategy?
Well, there's the old saying that the fish rots from the head, right? And I think in this is a very good example. All of its military failures stem from poor strategy from the top, right from the beginning. The strategy for Ukraine was built on three assumptions. One, that Ukraine wasn't a real country. Two, that it would offer no significant military resistance. And three, the West would not substantially interfere. You could probably get one of those assumptions for your strategy wrong, but getting all three wrong is fatal, because not only do you have a bad strategy, all the military plans that were based on that strategy are subsequently compromised, as we've seen play out in the North, the Northeast, and the Eastern offensive that's currently ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating that actually it stemmed from those initial assumptions and that miscalculation of what they were actually getting into from the get-go. Conversely, we've seen Ukraine outperform most expectations from analysts and observers on the ground in the conflict post 24th of February. So how would you assess Ukraine's performance and their strategic approach?
Well, if a fish rots from the head, it's also led from the head when it swims well. And that's the case with Ukraine as well. President Zelensky, whilst he was written off by many commentators and politicians in the West before this war, has done a couple of really important things. I think there's three that stand out. First, he has united the Ukrainian people in a way that they may not have been united previously. That has allowed the Ukrainian state to apply all its resources to fighting off the Russian invader. The second thing he has done is that in doing that, he has allowed his military commanders to get on with the job. He's clearly set political objectives for them, but he's allowed them to get on with their job. They have, I think, clearly war-gamed this scenario and prepared for it over many years. And the Ukrainian army of 2022 is not the Ukrainian army of 2014 for the Russians' last face. It is much better, much more professional. The third thing Zelensky done, and I think this has been very important, is he has shaped global opinion. He has been a strategic influencer par excellence. Maybe part of this is from his days as a performer, but he has done that and been able to solicit aid and assistance from many countries around the world, humanitarian, economic, and military, that is essential to the survival of Ukraine. So, you know, Ukrainians have both outthought and outfought the Russians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. That coherent message has been so critical. And also, as we know, a really important dimension to this war, it's partly occurring on the battlefield, but it's partly occurring in the information space. And we're seeing Zelensky managing to pull together a very coherent narrative in that regard that seems to have a lot of traction.
Absolutely.
So as we've seen this phase of the war progressing, let's say, since the 24th of February, we've seen by now, we've passed the May 9th victory parade in Russia that everyone was kind of building up towards and talking about. It's pretty clear that Russia is not going to be able to take full control of Ukraine and effect regime change. But that battle in the southeast is really intensifying. So what can we expect from here on in going forward?
Well, the Russians have to be successful in the east because there is no other source of victory in Ukraine at the moment. Potentially we might imagine a thrust out of Crimea or through Zaporizhzhia towards Dnipro, but they don't really have the combat power for it. So the east is what they've declared is their key objective, the Donbass, securing the people there. It's featured in military briefings, featured in President Putin's speech at Victory Day Parade on 9 May. He didn't mention Ukraine, but he certainly mentioned Donbass. So the Russians, one way or the other, have to manufacture a victory either in reality or at least in the minds of the Russian people. So they're probably going to fight harder there than they will elsewhere. But they're all, remember, war is a two-sided range and your enemy gets a vote. Ukrainians want to push the Russians out of as much of the territory that they've seized since 24 February. Now that they've done that north of Kiev, they've also just won the Battle of Kharkiv. Mm-hmm. The Ukrainians will be looking around, what's the next opportunity? Is it in the east? Is it in the south? One way or the other, I think they will act quickly and decisively.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there is a possible outcome in which Ukraine manages to completely evict the Russian military from the borders of Ukrainian territory as they were prior to 2014?
I think there's a very strong possibility of that. Certainly there is a political will to do that, both mm-hmm. in Ukraine, but also in the West. I mean, you have the Secretary General of NATO just over the weekend talking about Ukraine winning. I mean, 2 months ago, that just didn't happen. You know, that kind of narrative wasn't around in the West. Mm-hmm. But Ukraine has shown itself to be the best modern warfighter on the planet at this point in time. So NATO and others are backing them. I think a return to the 24 February borders is very feasible. Mm-hmm. Depending on whether Ukrainians strike next, you could see a rapid collapse of Russian forces in the east and their withdrawal back behind 24 February lines there. The south is another matter. There's a bit of a stasis on the southern front at the moment, but certainly the Ukrainians would be expected to turn their attention there if they're successful in the east.
Mm-hmm. I mean, massive costs and massive loss of life to potentially get back to where we were in 2014. But in any case, I'd also be interested in your quick response. We've been seeing with that sort of successful offensive now of Ukrainian defense forces recently, there was some talk of, are they actually going to make some incursions themselves into Russian territory near Volgograd? Now, it seems to me, as someone who's not a military expert at all, but what we've seen throughout history is that as soon as you actually step foot onto someone else's sovereign territory, you're potentially making a big mistake because then you start to ignite their resolve and their will to kick you out of their territory, which is a lesson I think that Russia is learning right now. So what would be your sort of response to those speculations?
No, I think you've hit the nail on the head, Jessica. I mean, the human will is an important part of all war. Indeed, it's the enduring nature of war. It's the interplay of human emotion, you know, anger, chance, friction, fog of war. And it's been a critical part of Ukraine's success, right? I mean, they have been motivated to defend their people, their territory and their sovereignty. The Russians, from top to bottom, haven't demonstrated that kind of purpose. I think Zelensky knows that. He understands it well. And whilst there may have been some sabotage activities undertaken potentially by Ukrainians throughout Russia, any kind of extended incursion into Russia by Ukraine risks not only, you know, how Ukrainian soldiers feel about being there, it certainly risks the strategic narrative that Zelensky has built up around Ukraine being invaded. It might compromise that. It risks potentially Western support. And what it would do is validate President Putin's imaginary existential threats to his country and make it real for he and his people. So there's far more risks and benefits than any kind of extended incursion onto Russian soil by the Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And finally, you mentioned something there that I would just like to investigate a little further, talking about those human aspects of conflict, which is also something that really struck me in your book. So in the book, you talk about how some factors have changed very much over time when we're looking at military engagements. We can think, obviously, of changes in technological capability, but some factors have stayed quite constant. And there we could look at things like the human dimension. And you mentioned how important that is, individuals' own capabilities and their own capacities for leadership, the way in which they engage at a human level in conflict. So I'm wondering if, it's kind of a big question, but could you comment on how, through that lens, how do you see that applying that sort of more human dimension to what we're observing in the war in Ukraine and the interactions between Ukrainian and Russian militaries there?
Yeah, I mean, this is an idea codified by Clausewitz, right, 200 years ago, where he talked about wars changing character, which is about where it takes place, what it's fought over, the kind of weapons are used. And secondly, wars enduring nature, which is all about the interplay of humans. This interplay of humans, because war is ultimately political, not military, and that's a really important point to emphasise. We've seen that play out constantly. Whilst there has been fighting on the ground, mass destruction of cities, the murder, the rape, the torture of Ukrainian civilians by Russian soldiers throughout this war, it has been a very human activity, as all wars are. It's about two sides wanting to impose their will upon each other. That is war's enduring nature. Artificial intelligence, autonomous systems in no way change that. They just change the kind of tools we use in warfare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating.
It's so interesting how you say that there's always that very human experience of the interactions between militaries on the ground, between soldiers and civilians, and then also what those individuals are ultimately going to take away from that conflict will be based a lot on that more human dimension, and whether, as you mentioned, ultimately one side succeeds in overpowering another side.
Well, thanks so much, Mick, for joining me today. I really appreciate it and appreciate your insights.
You're very welcome, Jessica. It's great to talk to you.
You've been listening to the Update from Kyiv podcast. Thanks to Mr. Smith for our theme music. See you next episode.